My own sentiment about the British mandate are probably no secret to any student of the Palestine question.
His Majesty's government in the United Kingdom undertook to work for the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people on the understanding that nothing should be done which might prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine.
I sincerely hope that when the Jewish people is secure in its independence, the present tension will vanish as a passing nightmare.
He had long advocated close counsel and partnership with Britain, so long as Britain was faithful to her charge. But by now it was evident to him that a struggle of resistance was essential against British plans to thwart and stifle Jewish nationhood. Mrs. Chaim Weizmann recounts an episode of Weizmann's harsh confrontation with the policies of the imperial power.
One particular incident struck me with horror, remains in my memory forever. A shipload of refugees blew themselves up in Haifa harbor and sank. Another boat arrived, no landing. Chaim bursts into the Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax's office. "No, the law is the law," said Lord Halifax, rejecting the plea. Weizmann: "I thought the difference between Judaism and Christianity is that the Jews take the letter of the law, whereas Christians temper it with mercy. Where is your Christian mercy?" Halifax: "There are moments in history when expediency takes precedence over moral values." Weizmann: "My lord, you have the expediency, and I have only moral values." Pale and shaken with his dignified statement, Lord Halifax allowed the landing of the boat with refugees.
"We have created quite a considerable amount of difficulties to the Palestinians. But human beings are there in order to create difficulties to each other. If the world were run smoothly, like in a class of pupils who are always very obedient and very goody-goody, well, the world would be a terribly dull place, and nobody would like to live in it. It is there, it is life, it is struggle. The administration would like us to go slow. I admit it's perhaps easier for the administration if people are going slow, and we were driven by all the furies of the world. We couldn't afford to be slow. Every slowing down of our progress meant so many deaths and so much destruction. And every Jew which we salvaged out of this hell of Europe was to us a gain, a double, triple, tenfold gain, particularly now."
After years of strenuous but unavailing effort, His Majesty's government have reached the conclusion that they are not able to bring about a settlement in Palestine based upon the consent of both Arabs and Jews, and that the mandate is no longer workable. It is for this reason that they have brought the problem before the United Nations, hoping that the General Assembly would be more successful in the search for an agreed settlement.
I shall never forget the dignity and pathos of Weizmann's appearance before the United Nations in October 1947 to plead for the establishment of a Jewish state. His own presence and advocacy had done much to secure the favorable United Nations vote.
"Give us a chance and do it, if I may say so, quickly. Don't drag it on and don't prolong our agony. It's lasted long enough and has cost a great deal of blood and sorrow on many sides."
"Well, Jewry cannot rightly claim to be one race composed of the descendants of Israel. History establishes that Western Jews, known as Ashkenazim, are the descendants of the Khazars who were converted to Judaism."
"I don't know whether the proof is valid or not, that I'm a Khazar, a Tatar, a Turk, anything but a Jew. I feel like a Jew, I have suffered like a Jew, and I intend to remain a Jew, in spite of the previous speaker's argumentation."
"Ideologically, Zionism is a 19th century nationalism, very much like Nazism, based on race mythology mixed with religion."
"I do not dispute the right of those two gentlemen to speak with some authority and intimacy on the nature of Nazism. I can't rival their contacts in that field. but on the nature of Zionism. I hold myself a better exponent than they. The character of our movement as a genuine effort at national liberation and society building cannot be obscured by such slander.
An American Zionist leader, Mrs. Rose Halprin, still carries a vivid memory of Weizmann on that memorable day.
It was a very moving experience. He was already old, very ill, almost blind. And when he got up to speak, one could see his manuscript from afar, for the letters were very large, so that even with his almost blindness, he could see a bit. And yet, despite the fact that he halted and stumbled and really could not read, there was hardly a man or a woman in that room who did not feel the presence of a great, great man. You know, he had in his own person a certain regality of bearing, and that came out. Weizmann, in his very weakness, represented the suffering, the tragedy of 6 million who had died. But he represented something else, too, the hope for the future, the end of an era, and the beginning of a new one.
Our remnants in Europe, who have before their eyes 6 million slaughtered kinsmen, cannot stand the thought of another dispersion. They do not throw themselves on the mercy of the world. They wish to be citizens of a Jewish society in which their capacities and ideals will be fully at home. To delude these people with exhortations to reconstruct their own graveyards or to fall as unwanted burdens on the mercy of reluctant powers, this is a mockery of their tragedy and an insult to their very suffering. A world which does not hear us in this moment of our agony would be deaf to the voice of justice and human feelings, which must be raised loud and clear if the moral foundations of our society are to survive.
We will proceed the roll call.
Afghanistan? No. Argentina? Abstention. Australia? Yes. Belgium? Yes. Bolivia? Yes. Brazil? Yes.
When it was assured that the vote was going to be favorable, I called the Plaza Hotel, where Weizmann was staying, and asked permission to see him.
On November the 29th, 1947, Weizmann was very near to journey's end. Abraham Feinberg was amongst the many of us who instinctively sought Weizmann's company on that unforgettable night.
He sat there in his shirt sleeves, his collar detached and open, pale, worn, with the tears flowing from his eyes. The only thing he said was, at last, we exchanged a few pleasantries, but it was quite obvious that he was exhausted, emotionally and physically. We then left. The sight of this great man reacting to the beginning of the realization of his aspirations was one which is etched on our memories and I know will persist for as long as we live.
That's it, ladies and gentlemen. Partition passed, 33-13, and is this crowd excited? They're starting their horror dances now. All over the square, little circles are forming. People are laughing and crying and shouting and whirling around in the wild horror dance. Perhaps you can hear it now. They're starting to sing Hatikva, the Jewish national anthem, away off in a corner of the square, and gradually, the horror dances are breaking up and people are taking up the refrain of Hatikva. All around me, I can see Jews weeping unashamed while they sing. Let's listen to them.
Nobody who lived that hour will ever forget its mingled sentiment. As preparations went forward for the establishment of Israel, its future president pondered on the constant scrutiny under which it would live.
It is proper to feel humility at the great hour of Israel's fortune. Yet I confess that it is a humility not unmixed with pride. None of us has any illusion that we shall be scrutinized on every step which we shall make, that all the telescopes and microscopes of the world will be trained on every act we shall do or on everything we shall omit to do. The jury of the world will be judged by what we do or what we fail to do in Israel. And I'm sure that all of us are animated by a prayer that we may be guided in the right direction.
Weizmann had been decisive in saving the Negev from being excluded from the partition plan. Let President Harry S. Truman tell us of the impact which Chaim Weizmann made on him and of the momentous political consequences that flowed from that encounter.
We had just finished two wars, and we had a country of our own to put back on an even keel. I guess that's when I began to feel that the presidential chair was about the loneliest place that a man could be. I gave orders that nobody was to come to see me and talk about the Palestine affair. But someone did come to see me, and he got in. His name was Eddie Jacobson. He came in, he stood around, didn't say very much, and was as quiet as he could be. I finally said, "Eddie, what in the world's the matter with you?" And then he told me that he thought that I ought not to keep Dr. Weizmann out of the White House. He thought I ought to see him. Dr. Weizmann's first name was C-H-A-I-M, and I didn't know how to pronounce it, so I called him Cham, called him that to his face, and he liked it. He was a wonderful man, one of the wisest people I think I ever met. He was a leader, one of the kind that you read about and seldom see. Dr. Weizmann came to see me. We had a long, long conversation. He explained the situation from his viewpoint, and I listened to him very carefully. And at the same time, I sent for Eddie Jacobson, and they both sat down and talked to me for a long, long time. When we were through, I said, "All right, you two Jews have put it over on me, and I'm glad you have, for I like you both." I used to keep a quotation from Mark Twain, which said, "Always do right. This will gratify some people and astonish the rest."
The United States recognizes the provisional government as the de facto authority of the new state of Israel.
This was done on the 15th of May, 1948. I felt that we were rather the conscience of the free world, and that's the reason why I so promptly recognized the new state of Israel.
Israel will be eternally grateful for the wide support which it has received by the deeply human statesmanship of President Truman, pioneer in the recognition of our state.
In the spring of 1949, Weizmann sought Catholic understanding of Israel's rights to Jerusalem. I recall accompanying him to Cardinal Spellman's residence in New York. Cardinal Spellman evokes the memory of that encounter.
"I found Dr. Weizmann a most personable individual and was pleased to have the opportunity of discussing world affairs with him. Naturally, he was very well informed about the situations both in Europe and the Middle East. And it was most interesting for me to hear his views on Palestine and to have his assurances that Israel would support and encourage controls for the immunity and protection of the holy places in Jerusalem. After Dr. Weizmann's visit in my home, I escorted him on his return walk to his hotel. It was a most friendly visit, and I cherish the memory of it and of him."
His last days were caught up in a tension between joy and frustration. He had seen the creation of the state, in whose establishment his role had exceeded that of any Jew in his generation. But by now he was too old and weak to impress the seal of his humane temper and experienced statecraft on the nation that he had helped to create. His closest friend, Meyer Weissgall, heard his testament as he lay dying in Rehovot.
"When I arrived there, it seemed, according to the doctors, a matter of hours or at most days. He recognized me immediately and clutched my hand very tightly, saying softly and with great difficulty, 'My heart, overflows with gratitude to all my friends. I don't deserve it. He did most of the talking during the whole half hour, haltingly, weakly to be sure, but with remarkable clarity and without a single lapse of memory. And he said, among other things, my greatest difficulty in lying here in this helpless condition is to watch and see all the mistakes that are being made in this country. Then he turned to me and in almost a pleading voice said, Meyer, you have been a loyal friend to me all the years I have known you. I have had other loyal friends, perhaps many more than I deserve. Tell them not to permit the destruction of the things we have labored for years to create. Then for a moment, tears seemed to come to his eyes. I tried to comfort him and say that things were not as bad as he thought. Then he gave a big sigh and said, Alibi, I hope so.
I call upon the assembly to rise and observe a minute of silent tribute to the memory of Dr. Chaim Weizmann, the president of Israel.
On a winter day in November, he passed away. He had dreamt of a Jewish life to be proud and free within the concert of sovereign nations. No dream had ever seemed more remote from fulfillment. With only a few thousand Jews in a derelict Palestine, with no armies behind him, with no political or economic strength at his command, Weizmann had transmuted a noble but vague vision into a political force. He could make people look beyond the gray present to an exciting future struggling to be born.
President Kennedy looked upon President Weizmann as one of the great leaders of his lifetime, who had given some direction and changed the course of events of mankind through his own strength of character, his own persistence, and his own courage. He represented a man who would not let the peoples of the world rest until his own people were free. There were individual leaders who gave President Kennedy some direction and some guidance and some inspiration, and I know President Weizmann was one of them.
The name and memory of Chaim Weizmann still endure. The present generation of statesmen is alive to the significance of his message. For that generation, let President Lyndon Johnson speak.
The great name of Weizmann does not belong to the Jewish people alone. It has enriched the moral treasury of your age. John Fitzgerald Kennedy believed in a partnership between science and public policy, and no man in this century has better symbolized that partnership than Dr. Weizmann. A great chemist, he was also a great statesman. Few nations have had a scientist as head of state, but all nations have begun to recognize their dependence on scientific progress. Science and the Weizmanns all over the globe are in the front line of this army that is fighting man's ageless foes, poverty and ignorance, misery and disease. His selection as the first president of Israel reinforced the unbroken moral tradition that linked him to the great prophets of an unforgotten past.
You ask me whether I miss Weizmann. Of course I do. I always considered him as my second father. And if I may be pardoned for what may seem immodest, he always treated me as a son, with affection and not infrequently as a stern parent. But in my opinion, the question should be phrased differently. Does Israel miss him? Does the Jewish people miss him? We miss him sorely. We miss his wisdom, his statesmanship, his calm judgment, his scientific objectivity, and above all, his great humanity, his great Jewish heart.
I hope we'll meet soon. I hope we'll meet in better days. I hope we'll see progress more than many people think. And I do hope that when we meet again, we shall be able to tell each other that we have overcome the crisis, that Israel is again on the high road to success, that many of the hopes which you entertained are in process of realization. And I know that at this moment, the stern God of Israel is looking down on its children and helps them on invisibly in their great task.